One of the things you notice the most in a cave environment is the heaviness of the atmosphere and the air. So because cave formations are done with carbon dioxide in the atmosphere, the carbon dioxide levels in the cave are often 200 times higher than what we're breathing out of the cave. So I guess scientifically right now we're sitting outside doing this interview and we're breathing in 0.04% carbon dioxide in the atmosphere, whereas in the cave that can be as high as 2.5 or 2.8. I've been in the cave where it's incredibly high.
Cave is a hole in a solid matrix. Perhaps we have a mountain, this is solid, and in this mountain we have a hole, and this is, we say, this is a cave. And the cave could be natural origin or could be man-made. A mineral is a homogeneous, natural, solid matter. That means that we have a chemical formula for this mineral. It's a natural process formed this type of matter. And of course, this is solid. And the consequence of this is that we have a homogeneous properties in the mineral. Of course, the minerals can change the color inside, but this is a continuous change, not a rapid change of density of color chemical composition. And that means that the minerals have a definite crystal structure and a definite chemical composition. A crystal is a solid. Is described or could be described with a periodical arrangement of the atoms. And that means that crystals formed clear shapes from the outer that they form clear faces, and the shape are definite by clear faces and flat faces. If they have space to grow, and of course we have different variation in crystals, perhaps quasi-crystals. They are also this is also possible to describe these quasi-crystals by periodical arrangement, but not in the three-dimensional space. So we have different possibilities of specificities of crystals, perhaps quasi-crystals or non-ordered crystals, and so on. But the main topic is that crystals have an anisotropic properties. That means that we have different properties in different directions. And the simplest example for this is a crystal grow. If the crystals have enough space and time to grow, crystals formed clear, flat shapes, faces.
So there's this heavy, heavy air. But then as the seasons change, so throughout the year when we have a low pressure system form off the coastline and the baromic pressure drops and changes, then the cave equalizes itself. And as the outside environment changes and the pressure systems change, the cave air changes and cleanses itself too. So I think that adds to the connection you build with the cave as you walk in throughout the different months and weeks and years and feel the cave air being different and heavy. And that's the air that I'm breathing into my lungs that sustains me. So that certainly makes a huge difference on how you experience the cave as well. So I think they're the things that I would definitely notice way more than someone who's not in there as much as me. Even though I probably have an enormous knowledge about all those other aspects, scientific aspects and understanding it, how it works. So when I'm down there in that environment and you become more sensitive to the environment, I'm sure I notice a huge amount. But how to actually put that into words, I don't even know if I'm supposed to or if we have enough expressive words in our language to do that. And especially when we're talking about something that's so minute and so small and happening so slowly, it's very hard to explain. once you fully start to internally comprehend in your body daily that this place is unbelievably old, you also at the same time, you'll internalize that you don't understand, you can never really comprehend how old it is. And I can't even describe how dark it is when we turn our lights off. And I'll go deeper into the cave and spend time in that environment. And it's so slow and it's so quiet that it forces you to do that personally as well. And then when you do that, I think when you're quieting everything down that's happening mentally but also physically in your body, and you relax as well in that still and serene and quiet environment, then you feel like you're more a part of it. And then as you do that, because you stop doing things, I guess, as cerebrally, like you're not, the thoughts aren't rushing through your head as much, then you really, I guess, slow down and become a part of it, which then can lead, well, leads me to start to see a lot of things of being really absurd when you come out of it.
I think we are the first generation now, or let's say we were living in the first epoch where humanity really takes a look at itself in the sense of a new form of self-awareness. It started actually in, I think it was 1957 or 58 when Sputnik was launched by the Russians. And the first satellite. And as of the 1960s, we are having satellites that do true Earth observation. And now we're having hundreds, if not thousands, of satellites up there. And they do permanently observe basically everything on the planetary surface and in the atmosphere. And we have a real-time reflection of our own activities. And this is frightening. I mean, even if it is not in that detail in the heads of the people, they do realize that it does make a difference whether we burn forests in the Amazon, that it does make a difference whether we have non-sustainable mining, that we have shipping fleets that pollute the oceans with their emissions from crude oil, and fleets of aircraft that pollute the upper troposphere, and so on and so forth. That doesn't go unnoticed, and it doesn't go unnoticed that the oceans are full of microplastics. Well, ask me how many microplastics we have in the soils. When we look back 30 years, so we're saying 1990. Wait a minute, that was very different from 1960, very different. Again, all over the world. Now we have 2020. So in 2050, again, we will look back to 2020 and say, well, that was a very different way of thinking. And we notice things like, be it Fridays for Future, be it also the rising awareness and self-esteem regaining of indigenous people all over the world. This is good. This is very positive. And they are not contradicting. They shake hands nicely in the figurative and sometimes in the literal sense. But how long it will take until we do the full Monty, I have no idea. Well, on one side, it is a permanent process. You permanently have people, in the figurative sense, waking up, allowing to see this, to accept this reality, and say, okay, maybe I should start to change my life a little bit. That happens all the time, and this is nothing new. We know from the past that a transition from one way of thinking to another takes about a human generation. So that's 30 years, roughly. But how long it will take until we do the full Monty, I have no idea. That may take several generations. It will get increasingly easy with the increasing pressures, because we humans tend to, let's say, get out of our lethargy when we get kicked in the bum. And the reality will just kick us in the bum when it gets more and more difficult to supply proper food, proper water, health supplies, etc., etc., for a growing population. when we want to avoid wars, when we fight increasing pandemics that are highly likely to occur, when we are facing the detrimental effects of climate change and related weather extremes. And so it's just a plethora of examples. And the hits are getting closer. And the more we feel this pressure, the more we have to adapt. And at the end, that's what it is. It is adaptation to boundary conditions. And usually this adaptation comes with an insight that it is smarter to behave differently.
Some people never left their own little boundaries, and again, that emotional luggage gets handed down. Some people, particularly old farmers, feel immediately threatened when they see Aboriginal people come onto their property. And Mum, like I said to you girls before, makes me laugh because you're like, settle down, boys. We just want to show you how to look after land. These kids love it too because it's that shared learning, shared teaching. And for me, prevention is better than cure. So when I do those sort of jobs with PLC, St Hilda's and all the elite schools that I've been working with for nearly 20 years now, particularly the girls' schools, again, prevention before cure. And some of these girls are now in positions of power because of their parents' privilege in their life, you know. So they actually can make a difference and they have the tools to do it. And they understood what I meant when I was talking to them when they were little. Oh, I say, I prefer to spend time with you fellas than all the kings and queens of the world because you are the future. All of us other fellas are yesterday, but you're tomorrow, you know. So, yeah, when you see a Sergeant Major's daughter sending me an email saying, Mitch, I made Dad pull the car over. That totem you give me was the kangaroo, and I could not see him run that kangaroo into the ground. I had to drag it off. The parents were telling me I was mad, but I told them, stop the car. I was like, go, Stephanie, you are deadly. Because they come on survival camps with me. And one of the girls come back, fully grown adult. She owns her own recording studio over in Sydney. And she's rocked up at the water and sand, and we didn't know I was going to be there. She was going to be there because volunteer when I can, you know. And I said, Juliet, is that you, my little fish, isn't it, like this here? That's you, my little Jiljet, which means my little fish, and I hadn't seen this girl for nearly 16 years. And she recognised her. We don't give totems lightly, girl. She goes, but you must see like 500 or 600 kids a year. And I said, yeah, but when you're in the bush with us for 8 days and we give you these things, it's not just pretend, you know.
So that would be worth reflecting over and possibly also discussing with Indigenous people that have this kind of reflection, and they do exist. they do very much exist. And yes, but at the end it always boils down to the same thing. We should not continue on this pathway.